You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 25th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Yay, Rebecca.
And Evan Bernstein.
Guten Abend.
As Rebecca is back from her intracontinental tour.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. It sounds really impressive when you put it that way.
Actually, she visited her neighbor for 3 hours. I mean.
Yeah, well, you know, I get busy sometimes. I have to keep myself scarce.
I know, a softball game comes up. And, you know.
Hey, I am on the CFI softball team, and we did just win our first game tonight. So I'm coming off a major high here.
Well, it's a good thing it didn't go into extra innings, because you'd be missing the show again this week.
So. Yeah, but it would have been worth it, because, yeah, CFI softball. How can you go
wrong? Rebecca, how do you like playing the bench warmer position?
I'll have you know that I was in the field the entire time because I am a girl, and they have to have so many women on the field at all times.
So you're a token. Cool.
Yes. Yeah. But I got outs, and I scored a run.
Mm-hmm. No, that's
these
good.
Are terms that Rebecca has not used. I got these things called outs.
maybe you've heard of them. And I just want to say that the team's name is Force Majeure, which is an awesome, awesome team name.
That is cool. Evan, tell us about today in history.
All right. Well, you're listening to this, most likely, on Saturday, May 28th. And it was on May 28th in 585 B.C.
Or B.C.E. for our international listeners.
In which a solar eclipse occurred, as predicted by the Greek philosopher and scientist Thales.
This He's was a witch.
They burned him at the stake. Now, the significance of this prediction is that it took place in the middle of a war that was going on between the Medians and the Lydians in what was known as the Battle of the Eclipse. They were fighting for about 5 years, and during the course of one of these battles, as the eclipse occurred, they stopped fighting. They thought it was a sign or an omen from the gods that they wanted this fighting to stop, and it did. It ended this war.
Those superstitious, primitive people. They should have just kept slaughtering each other.
In the dark?
Yeah. Oh, you wait a few minutes until the eclipse passes. Then
imagine, though, you have no idea what an eclipse is, and that must be earth-shattering. Like, oh, my God.
That's exactly right.
This solar eclipse event actually goes a little further in that it was technically the first predicted solar eclipse.
That's amazing.
Thales, this great man of science and a great philosopher, used science, and he's referred to as the one who kind of did away with mythology. He was the first one to employ a philosophy that it did not invoke mythological creatures or mythological gods and so forth.
How did he know that a solar eclipse is going to happen? He had just calculated out the intervals and...
It's believed, they're not exactly sure, but it's believed that he studied Egyptian techniques of land measurements, which were later codified by Euclid. And there's question as to whether Thales made the famous eclipse prediction himself, or if he borrowed it from the Egyptians. So that's a little point of historical controversy that continues to go back and forth.
Tell me he wasn't psyched when that eclipse came. He was like, yes!
I bet you he was a lot more psyched than Harold Camping was on May 22nd.
Oh, exactly.
Nice segue.
That guy.
So last week we talked about the impending rapture, which no thinking person thought was actually going to occur. And the big story was, what were people going to say on the day after when the rapture didn't occur?
Dope. And it turns out, not much.
Not much. They did interview him. You know that he actually has said many things about the prediction. And if you'll allow me, I have a couple clips that I'd like to play for you and the audience so that we can talk about his words exactly and his explanations as to why things didn't turn out the way he initially predicted. So here we go. Let's have a listen.
Scusi, mille regretti.
I can apologize. Yes, I did not have all of that worked out as accurately as I should have, or I wish I could have had it. That doesn't bother me at all, because I'm not a genius.
He's right.
Understatement of the year.
No, yeah, no one's arguing with that.
He doesn't care that people spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of their personal money putting up billboards all over the United States to tell people that
quitting their jobs too, sometimes threatening murder, suicides. Yeah.
He doesn't care that millions of people think he's a putz.
Oh, he still thinks the world is going to end on October 21st.
What? October now?
No, hang on. Yeah. Well, he's always
before
been saying,
Halloween?
He's always been saying October. The prediction was that May 21st was going to be the beginning of the apocalypse.
The rapture, right. Which is the ascent of the holy into the heavens.
Yes.
And which would have made for us like the greatest 6 months ever.
5 months. Right. Yeah, then 5 months of hell on earth, and then the ultimate final end of the world. On October 21st. That was the prediction.
Now, Steve, doesn't he believe that the fireball that's going to destroy the Earth is actually coming? It's on its way?
Well, it's going to be here in 5 months. It's got to be.
I've read Earthquake.
The earthquake was supposed to be May 21st, the start of
Well, the earthquake happened. I was at the American Atheist Rapture Party in Oakland, California, and Mr. Deity was there, and while he was speaking, an earthquake happened.
How severe was it?
An earthquake in California.
Yeah, it was tiny. It was like 3.2, I think, but fairly close by.
Did you feel it? Did you feel it?
Hey, 3.2 is pretty big.
I thought it was a train going by, I'll be honest. And when everybody started clapping, I turned to Amy and said, "What?" And she said, "It was an earthquake." And I'm like, I don't know. On the East Coast, we don't recognize that.
3.2s must happen every day somewhere in the world.
They do.
Multiple times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they happen every day in California.
Camping was predicting, like, the biggest earthquake ever that was going to work its way around the globe and destroy, make a lot of destruction. That didn't happen. No. So here comes the juicy rationalization. Camping was silent for a couple of days. You know, he was hunkered down trying to figure out what he was going to say. And, you know, news reporters did track down some of his followers, and they were saying things like, "I'm perplexed." Or someone else was saying that, "I guess our prayers have altered the plan in some way." But camping has a really nice rationalization. He said that he was right. The rapture did happen. It was just an invisible rapture. That was not apparent in any outward way.
I believe I have a clip of him saying those exact
words.
Would you like to hear him?
Oh,
go ahead.
Let's give him a listen.
And yet the sense of it is still the same, that judgment has come. Your world is now under judgment where it was not prior to May 21. Spiritually, there's a big difference in the world that we can't detect it all with our eyes, but we can know from the Bible.
There you go.
Okay, Evan, judgment did happen on May 21.
It was just a spiritual rapture, not a physical rapture. That was how they misinterpreted the Bible. So nothing happened, and they're still right.
I mean, so are we considered to all be in heaven right now? Like, what took place then?
Are the good people spiritless now?
No, what took place was, if you weren't saved prior to May 21st, it's now hopeless. There's no more opportunity to be saved.
You're done.
So therefore, there's no more need to put up billboards or to proselytize, because if you're damned, doesn't matter what you do now, from now until October 21st, you're already damned forever.
Damn.
Because the judgment is over. It's happened. It happened on May 21st, and it's all now written in stone.
You know, he's a numerologist, and he relies on numerology in uncoding these dates and everything from the Bible. You know, that back in... He's been doing this for a long time, and back in what, the 70s or 80s, he prophesied that the apocalypse would come in 1994, but said later that it didn't happen then because of a mathematical error that he made. Sound familiar?
Yep. Forgot to carry the two, as you said last week.
Exactly.
So what, that was his excuse, but he didn't go to the lengths of saying that it was a spiritual rapture.
I would have preferred that.
I was so influenced by the internet at that moment. So, guys, what's going to happen in October now? Let's make some predictions of what his excuse will be then.
October 22nd, yeah. Because it's hard to say, well, it was the spiritual end of the world, not the real physical end of the world. I mean, what could he say? He's going to go silent for a few days and then come out with some other ridiculous rationalization, special pleading, invisible floating dragon type of response. but it will have something to do with misinterpreting the Bible or the way the prophecies. Maybe it was 5 years and not 5 months. Who knows? I mean, they'll come up with something.
It's the epitome of special pleading.
If yes,
you wanted
exactly.
a textbook example of special pleading, this is it. Now, I have one more clip I'd like to play for you. And, Rebecca, I'd like your comments on this.
I don't want to hear this guy talk anymore.
Well, one more time, please. Because
yeah, my comment might just be one long vomit.
Yeah. Well, let's see what happens.
And I don't have spiritual rule over anybody except my wife.
Was it everything you thought, Rebecca?
And
he
more.
Said, I do not have spiritual rule over anyone except my wife.
Well, that's, you know, he is solidly backed up with evidence there. That evidence comes from the Bible. Men are to obey God and women are to obey their men. So, yeah.
Sounds like a plan.
Did you know he was a civil engineer? That was his career before he went into
really?
Proselytizing.
I did not know yeah. that.
And he has all these mathematical errors in his prediction. Would you want to drive over a bridge that this guy inspected? I mean, with all these,
yeah,
he can't get his Bible math right. How's he going to build? How's he going to help construct a bridge?
Yeah. Did he design the Narrows Bridge?
the one that collapsed
the first windy
the
day.
The Tacoma Narrows.
Tacoma Narrows. Yeah.
That's right.
All right, well, let's move on. We'll revisit this story on our first podcast following October 21st. We'll see what Rationals Agency has then.
Or whenever we want a good laugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll keep these clips handy.
Jay, tell us about the woman who tried to sell a fake moon rock.
Yeah, an American woman was recently caught in a sting operation by NASA and local sheriffs trying to sell a moon rock. So we're not actually sure if it was a moon rock or not. And I don't think NASA is either sure now or they might know, but they're not talking about it. I couldn't find any reference to it. But basically, it went down like this.
Wait a second. NASA participated in a sting operation?
Yeah.
Cool. I love it. Sorry, Jay.
Yeah, no problem. So the showdown happened in Lake Elsinore, California, where an undercover NASA agent pretending to be interested in buying the rock, they set up the sting operation. They'd been tracking her for a few months, and it ended up when she brought out the moon rock and she showed it to them and they were negotiating price and they settled on a $1.7 million U.S. dollar price. That's when they moved in on her. So after the conversation with the NASA agent, the moon rock comes out of a hidden place, and next thing you know, the place is bustling with local sheriffs and NASA agents. They took the rock and detained the unnamed woman, but they really can't say they arrest her or do an actual arrest because they're not sure if she had really committed an arrestable crime, because if it was not a moon rock, it's not anywhere near as big a deal if it was an actual moon rock. And then there's another thing, another layer here.
Well, wait. Hang on, Jay, there. I want to stop you there. Only because when I read this in the article, I was confused. But isn't pretending something is a moon rock and trying to get money for it, isn't that a crime?
Yeah, but it's the difference between being a federal crime and just a regular crime.
It's a federal crime to sell moon rocks that were collected by the Apollo missions for a couple of reasons. One, they're the property of the U.S. government, regardless of who has them or where they are. And number two, those moon rocks that came back with the Apollo missions are considered national treasures.
Right.
So it is actually against federal law for anyone to sell an actual moon rock.
But unless you collect it yourself.
Right, sure. Now, you can collect a moon rock from, say, an event that happens on the moon, like a really big impact happens, and then moon rock gets jettisoned off the surface of the moon, and it travels through space, and then comes into the Earth atmosphere.
Lands on your kitchen table.
Yeah, and that actually, guys, that's happened. They actually try to track down these events and try to collect moon rock. You know, it doesn't happen that often, but often enough where there are people that have moon rock from that. Sure.
You know, we have moon rocks from Antarctica. They're easy to find there because they're laying on top of ice.
Yeah. That's why they sent the Nazi scientist guy down to collect them, right? What was his name?
Dr. Strangelove.
So let me give you guys some cool facts that I looked up. I love reading about the space missions and anything to do with manned moon missions. They're so interesting.
Wernher von Braun. Sorry.
So like I said, the Apollo missions were the ones that landed on the moon and also collected moon rock. Not all of them, but you know, a handful of the Apollo missions did this. And these happened in the 1960s and 70s. Now, I did find some conflicting information online, and I really didn't get a chance to narrow it down to make 100% sure, but this is just one of the stats I read that said there were about 300 moon rocks were brought back. Some of them were passed out to the 50 states. So every governor of every state in the United States was given a very small moon rock, and then they ended up on plaques and on walls, and some of them ended up getting lost, which is incredibly horrible, but sadly true. And this was uncovered very interesting. It was a very interesting story about how this was actually uncovered by a teacher and a bunch of his students. He actually gave the students credit to track down all 50 of the rocks, and they found out that about 134 of the rocks that came from the Apollo missions are accounted for, but unfortunately the rest of them aren't, and we still don't know where they are. So the government is looking for the rocks, and I'm sure that there's always some type of an investigation going on. And they think that the rocks that were given to the states could be sold for around $5 million each. But I also read on a website that these rocks are considered priceless, and you know, that's a ridiculous term, but you know, priceless meaning, you know, pretty much whatever anybody's willing to pay, and it's of course in the millions of dollars. It's a, you know, huge dollar figure. The rocks that we did get back were as small as a grain of rice, about 0.05 grams and up to 1.1 grams.
Ooh, big boys.
Now also, moon rocks only came from three different things. One of them was of course the Apollo missions. The other one were samples that were returned by Soviet Union lunar missions. And finally, like I said, the ones that were ejected from the surface of the moon by impact. And finally, the main repository of the Apollo moon rocks is at the Lunar Sample Building at the Lyndon B. Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas.
Now, you know that the moon hoax claimers say that we got all of our moon rocks from Antarctica.
Yeah.
Or some of them say that. But those rocks are very different. They're very different than the ones that were found on the moon.
Oh, yeah, they were heated during reentry.
That's right. And the ones that were on the moon have these like micro pitting from the very tiny meteorites that impact the surface of the moon.
But what about cosmic ray damage and other types of radiation damage as well?
Exactly. Also, how would we know which ones were the moon rocks if we had nothing to compare them to?
That's a good point, Steve. Now, guys, the age of moon rocks is different depending on where they come from and how they, you know, like the impact ones, I think those are the ones that are older than the ones that are on the surface because they're deeper into, you know, down below the surface of the moon.
Regolith.
And also, there are different types of moon rock, and it's an interesting read to go into the different types and what they're composed of and everything. And another interesting fact, so much stuff on the web about this. You know, the moon rock has a lot of oxygen in it, and like we said before on the show, they could actually use moon rock to make fuel to return back to Earth. If we ever had people living on the moon, they could use it for fuel. They could also get water from the moon rocks. It's very very useful material.
Cool.
You could build stuff out of it, too.
That's right.
Yeah. Like a hat or a pterodactyl.
But I wonder if we should follow up on this story, because I wonder where she got the moon rock if it turns out to be a moon rock. And if it isn't, then you know, that's a lot of chutzpah. I mean, here's a piece of rock. I'm going to say it's a moon rock and sell it for $1.7 million.
Hmm. I would have gone for like no more than 1.1.
That'd be so funny if the rock was just this plain rock that was clearly not from the moon, from her backyard. This rock here.
How do you drum up someone that wants to buy a moon rock that has the money? You know, it's not like you're selling it to the neighbor's kid or anything.
I mean, yeah.
eBay. Well, it's kind of like when you hear about the big art heists. A lot of times the biggest trouble that thieves run into isn't stealing the piece of art. It's unloading it afterwards because the art is so valuable. You know, where do you find somebody who doesn't know that or care that you just stole it? You know, so moon rocks like art.
Yeah, those types of communities are very specialized, and everyone talks to everybody, and it's hard.
You know, guys, someday, because of advances in space travel in our lifetimes, we all might own a moon rock, a very small piece of the moon, because they're going to be devalued when we start bringing more and more moon rock back, you know?
I'll own a moon rock coffee table.
That would be dope.
That would, in fact, be dope. It's true.
Yeah, I have to admit that. Bob, tell us about dark energy.
Talk about an embarrassment of riches. Now, was this 2 weeks in a row? When did we cover Einstein being vindicated? Was that 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago? Either way, in very quick succession, we now have more key insights related to Einstein's theories that have been shown to be pretty much spot on. But this one, I think, is a little bit different. See if you agree. Astronomers in Australia and 13 other countries have produced a second and compelling wave of confirmation that the universe is indeed ever-expanding at an ever-increasing rate, vindicating yet again Einstein and relativity. Dark energy, then, is less likely now to be just a load of baloney. I mean, we had a series of experiments that really showed it fairly well, but these are very independent and somewhat compelling, and they're pretty interesting in and of themselves. The astronomers in question used cutting-edge spectrographs to map out about 200,000 galaxies. I think they took 4 years to do these experiments. Some of them are about halfway across the universe. The experiment was called Wiggle Z Dark Energy Survey. Kind of sounds like an episode Wiggle? Of Power Rangers, doesn't it?
Or the Wiggles.
Yeah. The goal was to get separate independent confirmation of the supernova experiments that were done in 98, I think, is the year that they really said, whoa, what's going on here? The universe is expanding at an ever-increasing rate. And this new experiment confirmed it in two separate ways. One was they measured the distribution pattern of galaxies in space, and the second way was they measured how fast clusters of galaxies formed over time. So by looking at these two patterns, they saw evidence that the universe is indeed speeding up its expansion and slowing down the attraction between matter. So that's pretty much the experiment. That's the gist of the experiment. It's very interesting. It's good to always have independent. I mean, it's always good to have independent confirmation of something, especially something as earth-shattering as this discovery that was made in 98. And that really just ushered in the whole idea of the dark energy pervading empty space itself, pushing things apart. I also think it's kind of important to mention that not every astronomer thinks that this is a feather in the cap of dark energy. There are some people now. I'm not sure. It was hard for me to get a kind of handle on how fringe these guys are. But people like Thomas Boucher, as a professor of cosmology at Claude Bernard University, France, and David Wiltshire is a theoretical cosmologist from the University of Canterbury, New Zealand. The latter was quoted as saying, if one makes the assumption that the universe expands as a uniform fluid, then these measurements are independent evidence of dark energy. However, I see no reason to make the standard assumptions. So Wiltshire believes that, he prefers an alternate model of the universe in which there's no need for dark energy, and in which the universe doesn't necessarily expand as a uniform fluid. Now, I'm not sure how fringe that is, but the interesting thing about these experiments is that the data that they've collected can be used to help vindicate, maybe this guy, maybe Wiltshire and his belief. They could use it to really flesh out some of these other alternate ideas that we might say at some point, hey, dark energy, there really is no need for dark energy. But right now, I think it's looking pretty good. And I think now we just got to – let's just find out what the hell this stuff is. If it really exists, let's try to get a handle on it. And, it's as elusive as dark matter. It's like, I have no idea what this stuff is. So that's pretty much that news item. And I thought it was pretty interesting. But when I first heard about it, I don't know. Somebody told me, or I got an email, and I thought that they actually determined what dark energy was. So I was all excited. I go to the news and I'm like, oh, they just have independent confirmation that it's expanding. So it was a little
anti-accelerating. Yeah, that the universe is accelerating. Therefore, something like dark energy is one explanation for that.
But this is important after all. I mean, 73% of the universe is dark energy. I mean, or that's how it seems now. And dark matter is about a quarter. I mean, everything that we thought was the entire universe is only 4%. All the ordinary matter, stars and galaxies.
And most of that is intergalactic gas. All the stars and planets is 0.4%.
Yeah, it's really kind of pathetic. So it's just amazing that we know so little about what the vast majority of the universe probably is. Now, there's another thing that bugged me. And Steve, tell me if you kind of agreed with this. It always seemed kind of odd to me that Einstein was linked to this whole idea of dark energy.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. Einstein's the man. No question about it. But do you guys know why he's actually even associated with dark energy?
No, Bob. Please tell us.
Okay. Oh, sure, Rebecca. General relativity, actually predicted the universe was expanding or contracting, but Einstein wouldn't believe it. This is amazing. This is a guy that had so many incredible insights into the universe. And he's looking at this theory, and it's like, wow, it's telling me the universe is expanding or contracting. It's everyone thought, though, at that time that it was static, and it was such an entrenched frame of mind. Nobody, I mean, even Einstein was like, no, I can't believe it. So he actually throws in this fudge factor, which he called the cosmological constant. He just makes up this counterforce. He just pulls it out of his butt. He throws it into his gravitational field equation to balance gravity and to make the universe static again. And it's just so weird. And I mean, of all the feathers in his cap, this would have been yet another incredible feather in his cap of actually being the person to predict that the universe is expanding or contracting. But it took a few years later, of course, for Hubble to really prove it. And then, of course, Einstein said, "Doh," and referred to his cosmological constant as his biggest blunder of his career.
Which it was.
It really was. And it was really, it just didn't seem to fit, never fit him, I think. I just don't know why he didn't go with that. But now, decades later, you know, we find that gravity isn't slowing expansion. It's speeding up because it's some mysterious force like the cosmological constant. So Einstein apparently is a genius even when he makes big mistakes.
Yeah, but for the wrong reason. Now, he was wrong.
Right.
He got it wrong. The cosmological constant was wrong. And the fact that, you know, is a repulsive force, and now we're thinking that there is a repulsive force, any credit for that.
Right.
Rebecca, you're going to tell us what you've been doing for the last week while you were gallivanting around and not recording the podcast. But you were giving a talk on something to do with skepticism.
No, I mean, it was mostly just the gallivanting.
Okay.
Knew it.
Well, first, I should give a shout out to our friends at Pixar who gave me a tour.
No, I forgot about that.
Oh, man. Tell us every single detail.
Holy crap.
Did Buzz Lightyear greet you at the door?
I can't tell you every detail or they would kill me. They wouldn't kill me, but they would take away all the toys they gave me.
No, you better be teasing us.
What did they pick out for me? Like, what did they say, Rebecca, give this to Jay? What was the one?
I'm getting the Woody.
They actually said, take all of these toys and enjoy them yourself and tell the guys that you got them so that they will be jealous and they will come visit sometime. Yeah, and that was from Chris Ford, and Craig Good is the person who got in touch originally and brought me out. So Hello. Thank you very much, guys, and to the other guys I met as well at Pixar. It was a good time.
Pixar.
That
I am
was
so jealous.
That was Pixar. I also got to see the Mythbusters set, which was awesome.
Oh, cool.
And I can't talk about that at all because spoilers, but Ooh. I can tell you that it involved something very large that
and
smashed
blowing
things.
Up.
Close. There was smashing.
They built their own proton accelerator?
I can't tell you that.
Now that would be cool.
That would be cool.
So thanks to Adam Savage for having me out to the Mythbusters set. But yeah, so I was talking about I was there to speak about activism and free thought and all of that, and I decided that I would focus on women because I am one, and
it's kind of your shtick.
Wait, are we done with Pixar now?
Sorry, Bob.
All right. Go ahead. Keep talking about women. That's a good topic, too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's become my shtick, though. You're absolutely right. It never was meant to be. But the problem was that I noticed that nobody else was really talking about women. So I figured that I probably should. So in particular, this time around, you know, in the past, I've spoken on particular kinds of pseudoscience that are marketed towards women. I gave a talk at CFI just a little while ago that just went online, actually, about how Oprah has sort of made her living out of directing pseudoscience at women. But in this case, you know, I was speaking to secular groups that were mostly concerned with things like separation of church and state. So I spoke about how the religious right in the U.S. is directly affecting women's rights, particularly by taking away their access to basic health care. The religious right has been focusing on things like instituting abstinence-only education and reducing or attempting to prevent people from getting access to contraception, and also making all abortion illegal. So in my talk, I discuss the ways that they are using biblical doctrine in order to support these policies. And this doctrine doesn't actually hold up when you look at the scientific evidence. So I was encouraging secular organizations and skeptics and atheists and everyone that was in the audience to start paying more attention to how the religious right is having a very serious negative impact on women's well-being in America. I also did a short post on Skeptic wrapping up some of the major points, so people can check that out if they weren't at the lectures. Abstinence-only education has been scientifically proven in study after study after study to not work if what you are hoping to do is reduce the number of teen pregnancies, reduce STIs, things like that. And yet they're pushing these policies because their religion is telling them that it's simply wrong for people to have sex and it's wrong for them to use contraception. If people do have sex, they are to be punished, and they should be punished with babies or STIs. And abstinence plus education is a really sneaky way of getting abstinence-only education into the classroom. You guys are probably familiar with the wedge theory, right? We've talked
yeah.
about that.
Oh, yeah.
In the past. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's something, if new listeners aren't aware of it, that's something that creationists use to wedge their creationism into public schools. They do it by, you know, first they try the big stuff, like trying to get creationism simply taught in schools. When that fails, they lessen it a little bit. They try to get certain language put into, you know, into the rules that allows them to encourage teachers to mention intelligence design or just kind of poke holes in the theory of evolution. So that's the wedge theory, and the idea is they get a little bit in and then they wedge the rest in. Well, I think Abstinence Plus is very similar to that. Abstinence Plus is, on its surface, it sounds like, well, at least they are getting, you know, some education about contraceptions. But it's not actually a full complement of sexual health education. What it is it's a focus on abstinence-only education. And for the bulk of what children learn is abstinence-only. And then at the end, there's just a few sort of token things thrown in about, oh, and condoms, blah, blah, blah. Just don't have sex. So it's a sneaky way of getting abstinence-only education in.
Yeah, but they do claim that it's effective. So they have a clear ideological agenda. And at least if they said, this is what we believe, you know, religiously, ethically, and that's why we advocate. I mean, they do say that, but they don't say that that's the primary reason. Then they try to bolster their ideology by making false scientific claims.
Correct,
When the evidence is clear. The evidence is abstinence only is not effective. Giving kids information about how to protect themselves is effective. And they also make the counterclaim that such education, you know, anything other than abstinence only, encourages children to have sex. And there's no evidence to support that either.
Right. There have been a ton of big studies done, and every single one tells us that abstinence-only education leads to more teen pregnancy. Saying that education about contraception leads to sex is like saying owning a fire extinguisher leads to fires. It's the same sort of thinking that goes into these same people who campaign against vaccines, the cervical cancer HPV vaccine that doctors are encouraging girls to get before they become sexually active. It could literally save their lives. They could not die of cervical cancer in the future. But these same groups are campaigning to stop doctors from giving girls these vaccines because they believe that giving the girls the vaccine will encourage them to go have sex, which is just utterly ridiculous and not supported by any science.
Rebecca, when you give these lectures, do you ever get anyone argue with you or talk back about it?
Amazingly, the most recent few lectures have been, like, the Q&As were all 100% positive, and they would go even further. They, you know, a lot of the audience was very well informed on the issue already. Not a lot of the audience, I guess, some of the audience members, and they did a great job of contributing additional ideas and pointing out additional problems that we have combating the religious right, and also pointing out additional ways that people can help.
Well, let's end the news segment on a bit of a lighter note. Are you guys aware that the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has put out a public awareness campaign educating people on how to prepare for a zombie apocalypse?
Yes, I thought it was brilliant.
It was a great marketing scheme, yeah.
Wait. There's a zombie apocalypse, and they're warning us about it right now?
It's in preparation for it.
Yeah, so it essentially was very clever. What they realized was preparing for any disaster has most of the same elements. You need food and water, ability to communicate and organize, you know, your family and loved ones, knowing what the government resources are and how to access them. So they went through that the preparedness kit. And so it says their slogan is get a kit, make a plan, be prepared. But they did that in the context of a zombie apocalypse, which, you know, the same preparations you would need if there was a hurricane or a nuclear war or whatever. So, yeah, but of course they got a lot more attention for their campaign than they would have gotten if they didn't put it in the context of a zombie apocalypse. So it was pretty funny.
Well, kind of like those scientists that did that. They released that study on epidemics, right? And they compared it to zombie plague. It's a similar idea.
Yeah.
You know, getting this study out there, making it pretty much go viral and getting millions of dollars worth of free advertising because they tied it into a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah. So, like, for example, they go over things like pick a meeting place for your family to regroup in case zombies invade your home or if your town evacuates because of a hurricane. it's very tongue-in-cheek, very funny. Good job.
But, Steve, they missed a couple of things. You know, they list water, food, medications, tools and supplies, mm-hmm. sanitation and hygiene, clothing and bedding, important documents, and first aid supplies. Bob?
Supplies.
What did they miss? Guns.
Weapons.
Shotguns.
Yeah, weapons. Yeah. Lots of them.
Mm-hmm. How else are they going to fight off that hurricane? I mean zombie.
Yeah. They definitely did not include how to arm yourself. So you could go to the Zombie Survival Guide if you want a long discussion on that. Although
not very accurate, I heard.
Yeah, I heard.
Disappointingly.
Yeah, it's not very accurate if you really know your way around weapons.
Take it for pure entertainment, but that book is surprisingly thorough. It's incredible, all the ground he covers.
Now, do you guys know who Mike Adams is? Mike
is
Adams.
Is he related to Neil Adams?
Nope. He's the health ranger.
Oh, that guy.
Natural
yeah.
News.
Only you can prove
it. Of course.
Yeah,
how
what does he have to do
Mike
with this?
Adams.
He's a jackass. So he wrote an article for Natural News. The CDC warns Americans to prepare for a zombie apocalypse, and then in parentheses, really. And then he treats the campaign as if it were serious, not tongue-in-cheek. And he then tries to link that to a real zombie apocalypse because of vaccines.
What?
So vaccines are going to cause a real zombie apocalypse by rotting your brain.
Cool.
Really? So, really?
Right, Steve, you are an agent of the zombie
I knew it.
Horde that is about to walk
It makes
earth.
A lot of sense, actually.
Right. And he even says it. Listen to this, guys. But the CDC says nothing about weapons, not even basic combat knife or a .22 pistol to keep handy. I guess the idea of people preparing for emergencies with some citizen weaponry isn't something the government wants to encourage, huh? Just to be sure to have your papers in order, but not your personal safety. So this guy's a real conspiracy theorist, anti-government loon as well. So,
yeah, he thinks that the government is giving false information on the zombie apocalypse so that we'll be unprepared and unweaponized by the time they come at us with their vaccines.
Wow, that's brilliant.
No, it makes perfect sense, actually, when you put yourself in the place of an utter.
Yeah. I mean, he also thinks that, like, the fluoride is killing you in the water. And
that's true.
I'm pretty sure he's also a 9/11 truther.
Why not?
Mike Adams is 100% a total idiot.
Except he's making millions off of one of the most popular health sites on the internet. So, we always have this conversation. Does this guy for real, does he believe even a tiny fraction of the nonsense that he spouts on his website? Or is he just laughing all the way to the bank, you know, and putting out the most inflammatory stuff because it drives traffic to his site where he sells supplements and makes a ton of money.
He's got to believe it. I mean,
who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
I think he does. I honestly think he does. But
I guess he does.
But
because
if they didn't,
you would have to be not just sociopathic, but I mean, it's kind of a long shot. You know, if you were a sociopath, if you didn't care about causing deaths worldwide from encouraging people not to vaccinate, I don't think you would choose to go into that business. I don't think you'd be like, I'm going to start a website. No, I think you have to buy into it.
Kevin Trudeau?
Yeah, but he's covered everything, you know?
Yeah, he's bounced around a lot. Yeah, this guy seems to be a little focused.
Yeah, there's one paragraph in here that sums it up quite well. What the article failed to point out, however, is that the neurological damage caused by vaccines creates zombie-like effects in human brains, including crippling the ability for independent thought and sapping willpower. Vaccines and fluoride, combined with other toxic synthetic chemicals found in foods, medicines, and consumer products, actually, in quotes, zombify human brains and transform intelligent minds into gullible human followers. From there, television news tells people what to think, what to buy, what to believe, and how to vote.
Wow, that's a pretty slippery slope.
Yeah, that's why half our population in the United States votes Republican and the other half votes Democrat, right? So there's two different governing bodies here that are controlling half the population.
Right, this is the one thing they all agree on, is let's control the population.
Maybe, yeah, they're all on the same side, Jay. I mean, are you buying into this superficial layer of parties and everything? That's all the window dressing to make you believe the con.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all in on it together.
They conned me.
It's like when the Joker teams up with the Riddler.
I get confused.
This guy calls himself the Health Ranger. He's more like a LARP player.
Don't say it, Jay. He's now, so I think the next one will be that for the CDC, perhaps, is the vampire hordes that will attack. And perhaps they'll have drills to help prepare us for that.
I don't know. So. Twilight's pretty much over. I think they missed the... the bow on the
There's
Twilight.
Lots of vampire stuff still going
or,
on.
Or, if you want a really good short read, read Max Brooks, who did World War Z and Survivor.
And History of the World and Young Frankenstein.
No.
What?
Not Mel Brooks.
Sorry, dude. No, the guy who wrote World War Z, Max Brooks, also wrote a short story, a novella, called Extinction Parade, which actually pairs zombies and vampires in a very creative, interesting way. So it's a recommended read.
You
can knock it out in a half hour. Very cool stuff.
That's that's two thumbs up and falling off from Bob.
Evan, tell us about Who's That Noisy?
Yes, I will do that. Here is last week's Who's That Noisy, for those of you that have forgotten.
That better not be a dying cat.
So what is that?
That's a frog.
A frog.
A frog.
Doing what?
I'm the frog, see?
Some frogs scream.
It's a screaming frog.
You pick up a frog and sometimes...
What a terrible frog.
There are dozens of examples of screaming frogs on the internet. Just type in screaming frog and you'll come up with 70 of them, like right off your first page. Who knew that a frog could make such a noise?
It's the screaming frog of Llandudno.
Evan, is this a result of them finding out that their hard drive crashed or their wife cheated on them? Like, what prompts this scream?
You're right. Actually, you're right, Jay. And what they should do is have a camera overhead so when the frog looks up with its little webbed feet towards the sky, you know, towards the sky, and it pulls away, you know, that typical camera shot of ultimate agony. Someone on their knees. Yes, that's exactly what's happening.
Oh God, it's such a weird sound. I can't imagine a frog doing that.
Well, that's a failure of imagination on your part. Especially after you just heard it.
For the first time. And ironically, someone from the message boards named Parrot was the first one to guess correctly.
Parrot?
Parrot gets the frog.
Parrot takes frog. Good job, Parrot.
All right. What do you got for this week, Evan?
All right.
Something good, I hope.
Well, it's good. Wait till you hear this. Here is this week's Who's That Noisy?
To quantum physicists like Amit Goswami saying, you're seeing prana and chi, you're seeing the life force. To consciousness expert Stuart Hameroff saying, oh, synesthetes have a lower threshold to quantum consciousness. This is an entanglement, much like psychic phenomenon.
Entanglement, obviously.
Crystal newage.
What about decoherence?
So what you have to do is try to decipher that claptrap.
Who's that flaky?
Figure out who's, who's talking about that. And give it your best guess. Send us an email. All right. Post it on the message boards. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. Could do one email this week. This one comes from Jez Morris, who says, he writes, Jez Morris, 26 UK. Now, you might remember a while back, we asked our listeners to include their IQ with their name and location in the email. But I'm not sure if that's what Jez is doing here. What do you guys think? Is that his IQ or his age?
Wait, what is it?
What was the
26.
Number?
26.
I'm gonna hope for IQ because it'll be a much more interesting.
Does IQ run like Fahrenheit and Celsius? You know, two measurements for the same thing.
What do you mean?
You can have anyone.
there's one IQ number.
My IQ is 26 Celsius.
26. Yeah, 25 Celsius is a 77 Fahrenheit. So 26.
It's actually a logarithmic scale, like earthquakes and pH. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Right. So we'll assume that's age. Jez writes, "Dear Stephen and fellow skeptics with a C from the UK, having discovered the show a few weeks ago, I have now become somewhat addicted, gradually working my way through the back catalog of episodes. Please keep up the good work. I never realized that I was a critical thinker skeptic until listening to this podcast, but would now put myself firmly in this bracket."
We get that a lot.
Yeah. "Listening to the radio this morning, I heard a story that had all the hallmarks of pseudoscience, scaremongering, and political ignorance, and wondered what your take on it was. Denmark has banned Marmite, along with Ovaltine, Rice Krispies, and Shreddies, on the grounds that they have added vitamins and that fortification poses a public health risk. An interviewee from Denmark said that other mothers had approached her and warned her not to give her children Ovaltine as it had too many vitamins. This sounds like the sort of nonsense peddled by cranks, so that I was amazed to hear it had been enacted as law in a developed Western nation. Is there any scientific basis for these claims? Best regards."
Nope. Next.
Thanks for writing.
It is interesting. So I looked into this a little bit. Actually, in 2004, Denmark banned multiple breakfast cereals from Kellogg's, including Rice Krispies, Corn Flakes, Special K. This comes from a law around that time that any food that has fortified or added vitamins has to get special approval from the appropriate board in Denmark, the Danish Veterinary and Food Administration.
It's the fortification.
Fortification. And they did not give approval for those products, said that they posed a health risk. They actually wrote, "We've turned down applications for a number of enriched products which will have toxic effects in the doses Kellogg uses."
Red flag, toxic.
Toxic effects. Kellogg's responded, "We're extremely concerned and mystified as we never have had such problems with health authorities before in Kellogg's history." So they're claiming that the amount of vitamins in these food products are too high and will actually cause vitamin toxicity.
Well, this is what they did claim back in 2004, right? That's what you're saying?
This is the purpose of the law. This is why they essentially banned Rice Krispies and Frosted Flakes.
They must hate total cereal. That thing's fortified all
the time. Yeah, right. Now, with regard to Marmite and Vegemite, they are now saying that this law is still in force, but they have not banned these two food products. Marmite, by the way, is this brown, yeasty thing you could spread on toast. It apparently is disgusting unless you've developed...
It is delicious.
Unless you've developed a taste for it, in which case you'd love it.
Why spend the time developing it?
It's like the bottom of a cask of beer.
But what's the difference between this and Vegemite?
I think they're very similar.
They are similar, but Marmite tastes a lot better. Vegemite's sold in Australia, and Marmite is sold in the UK primarily.
Yeah. So what they said was, "We didn't ban them, but neither of them have applied for permission to be marketed in Denmark. Therefore, they can't be marketed because they're fortified until they apply." So they're not banned, but they're pseudo-banned until they apply for permission, and then we'll have to wait and see what they decide. But, if they go the way of Rice Krispies, you know, they'll get banned. So the scientific question here is the amount of vitamins in these products, does it pose a health risk from vitamin toxicity if you you know, like have a bowl of Rice Krispies every day or eat them as is recommended? And the answer is no way. They're not anywhere near having enough. I mean, again, I'm not a fan of vitamin supplementation. I think it's generally unnecessary if you have a good diet. But, you know, you can get a little bit of extra vitamins in cereal. And, you know, I don't mind if my food is fortified, even if it's unnecessary. There are some fortifications that are good, like vitamin D in milk and iodine in salt and things like that. But
what about vitamin A? Because isn't it fairly easy to get too much vitamin A and it can cause some significant problems? But that's usually like if you're taking a multivitamin and things.
Yeah, so vitamin A absolutely is one that you can OD on. And remember we talked about Airborne, which actually had three times the RDA of vitamin A in it. And if you took it as directed, you actually would get a toxic dose of vitamin A. But the same is not true of these cereals. You're not getting enough vitamin A. I mean, they typically, if you look at the box, they typically have 20%, 30% of the RDA. You know, nowhere near.
Well, but that's the RDA for U.S., not for Denmark. Maybe they just have ridiculously low RDAs.
Even if they have low levels, I mean, there is a pretty broad buffer between the RDA, which is just the minimum you need to get in order to stave off a deficiency syndrome.
Yeah.
Right. So it's actually most people argue that the RDAs are too low, again, because it's just the absolute minimum you need in order to not get a deficiency syndrome.
Right.
There's a broad range over which you get enough to be healthy, but not too much to be toxic. And you have to take quite a bit. I mean, there are some vitamins where you can get toxic levels from multivitamins that have, you know, much higher levels than the RDA,
yep.
You know. But no, cereal, it's just silly. And there's no evidence to suggest that there's anyone getting vitamin toxicity from Rice Krispies. I mean, they're just making that up. I mean, it's just not the case. It is fear-mongering.
A supplement company came in to visit the place where I work out in martial arts studio to you know, peddle their wares on us, and it was a drink of some sort. And I'm reading the label on it. 2,000% of your daily allowance of vitamin C. And I pointed that out to him. I said, that might be a little bit of a problem. Reading the labels is key.
Yeah. Right. So that, you know, it's the mega dosing, which is the problem. And I always advise my patients, at the very least, don't take mega doses of any vitamins. Best case scenario, you pee it out and you have so-called expensive urine. Worst case scenario, if it's, you know, the fat-soluble vitamins like A, D, E, K, you actually can get to toxic levels.
Steve, how do we know what levels are actually required for a particular body weight, though?
Well, we study it in animals, and we also, you know, measure levels in people who develop the diseases. And, you know, we obviously can't experiment on humans and deprive them and see, you know, what levels cause disease. But
even inmates?
There's a lot of lines of evidence. Yeah, so there's lines of evidence that we extrapolate from. But you could, you know, there's obviously room for interpretation. And recently, you know, new evidence caused us to raise the recommended minimum daily allowance for vitamin D, for example, as new evidence was coming in.
Well, Steve, follow my line of reasoning here, because I've been thinking about this for the past few years, actually, you know, lots of discussions with friends and with you and, you know, everybody. We talk about nutrition quite often. For example, we would figure, you know, a 15 to 1700 a day caloric intake on average.
That's low, actually. Average male, 2500, female, 2000, and then you adjust that for activity level. So 1800 is actually a little bit on the low side. That's like a weight loss caloric intake or somebody who's sedentary.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm both of those. So, so let's say you average 2,000 calories a day you're taking in. You know, you could figure out about how much food that is, right? Or very accurately how much food that is. You know, you're having X for breakfast, X for lunch, X for dinner, a couple of snacks.
I usually have Y for dinner myself, but yeah, go ahead.
But the idea is...
Nice. I have a glass of wine with dinner too.
Even if our food that we buy today is nutritionally compromised, and isn't where it should be, right? If we were going to make the, like, what were people eating 1,000 years ago argument, which I don't agree with, there's no way that any human would encounter megadoses of anything just by eating fruits and vegetables.
You'd have to go out of your way. So there have been cases where people have consumed a lot of carrots and got beta carotene toxicity from that. So
it turned orange.
Yeah, their skin gets a little yellowish glow. We covered this item, actually, that actually eating vegetables does affect the color of your skin, and you can overdo it. So, but you have to, you know, have a very narrow or repetitive diet. That's why the single best advice is just have a varied diet, and you pretty much can't go wrong. As long as you're not obsessively eating just one thing, hard to overdo it.
Including meat, Dr. Novella?
I would say meat in moderation is fine, but you should, you know, eat lean meat. you know, lots of chicken and fish, little bit of steak. Just it's easy to overdo it on the steak, and probably Americans eat too much red meat. Yeah, a little bit of meat in your diet is fine. Getting back to the Denmark thing, though, so I did read a lot about this, and there were a lot of comments were speculating that this has more to do with just like a ridiculous nanny state, you know, and unfounded fears about vitamin fortification, and that they were actually using this law as an excuse to maybe keep out foreign competition or ban foreign companies or products. And for example, like with Marmite, you know, a lot of people were saying the only people in Denmark who eat Marmite are, you know, expatriates from the UK, and the Danes are apparently there's some tension there.
Yeah, because the Danes like, you know, less strongly tasting things like lutefisk.
Right.
What?
But
what's that?
Lutefisk?
Lutefisk is a...
Yeah, it sounds like you just made that up. Lutefisk.
No, it's actually... it's mostly primarily eaten in like Norway and Sweden, I think.
Yeah.
But it's...
Because they can't get anything else?
It's like a salted white fish that is gelatinous.
Oh, yeah,
really, really, really... strong smelling, odoriferous.
Yeah, I think we've talked about that before, actually. Mm-hmm. But the Danes love it, apparently. But the other people said, no, it's not about the foreigner thing. It's really that Denmark is a obsessive nanny state. They really think they're doing the right thing to protect their people by doing this. So, you know, sounds like more mainly opinion, but that was sort of the range of opinions I was reading about what their motivation was behind this. Either way, it's not scientifically justified.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Yes.
Ready.
Here we go. Item number one, new research finds that electrons, rather than being spherical as previously thought, are distinctly egg-shaped. Item number two, researchers find that women find expressions of happiness less attractive than expressions of pride or shame in men. Item number three, biologists discover a bacterium that uses caffeine as its sole food source.
I am that bacterium.
Rebecca, since you were not here last week, you get to go first.
Ah. That also means I just got into town. I haven't read any science news items. All right.
How dare you, Steve?
So electrons are not spherical. They are egg-shaped. And not just egg-shaped, but distinctly egg-shaped. Well, that's interesting. I mean, well, that reminds me of, you know, Earth was thought to be spherical for a long time, but it turns out it's an oblate spheroid. I don't think it's egg-shaped, but
it's a lopsided oblate spheroid too.
I could see that being true. Women find happy men less attractive than prideful or shameful men. Yeah, I can buy that too, because we lady folk like our men strong and silent, not all happy-go-lucky.
And uppity, yeah.
Yeah, we don't want uppity, uppity dudes. Yeah, so okay. Yeah, sure. I mean, shame is a bit weird. Like, why would you find shame attractive? And when I picture shame, I picture like the dog that just peed on the carpet in front of you. I don't really know why that would
be
attractive.
I hate when I do that.
But okay. And a bacterium that uses caffeine as its sole food source. That's interesting. I wonder, I mean, would that mean that people who drink more coffee, for instance, might have more of this particular bacterium? I know that, a lot of, having a lot of caffeine can upset some people's stomachs. Maybe that's why. Probably not. But, I think it's between that one and the electron one. And honestly, this is a total coin flip for me. So I'm trying to put myself in Steve's shoes. Which one of these sounds like something that is true, but only slightly tweaked? And I think it's the caffeine one, because I think maybe it's actually something like bacteria that just likes coffee or something. But not actually caffeine. I don't know. But it's a coin flip. I'm going to go with that one as the fiction.
The caffeine one.
Yeah. Why not?
Okay. Jay?
Okay, the one about the electrons being egg-shaped. Man, I don't know anything about that. I can't think of any reason why they would actually have a shape. Right? I mean, aren't they just a...
Well, they have to have some shape.
Well, yeah, but they're – oh, man. I'm just going to say a bunch of things that's going to make me sound really stupid right now.
Do it.
Did you think electrons were invisible?
No, but I think of them more as energy than I do as something physical, and I know that Bob's not going to agree with that.
Wave-particle duality, man.
Yeah, like shape is – I don't know, man. That's interesting. I would love to hear the science behind that, but I can't comment on that. Researchers that find that women are attracted to happiness less than pride and shame. Yeah, that's a mouthful right there, boy, if I ever heard one. Okay, you know, I can see that. I could see that there might be something about pride and a man expressing shame that could be have an advantage for other reasons other than, you know, just the exterior. Like, he's a happy guy, I love him. Like, there could be good things about that when in regards to having a family and, you know, being a caregiver and a protector and all the things that cavemen do for cave women.
Club them over the head and drag them around.
Yeah, right? I have like a default like man-woman relationship that I go back to where like when evolution was, you know, really firing big. Like other than like today, plug. Where we eat McDonald's all day, and evolution is basically happening in my bathroom. all right, and then the last one. Don't ask. I don't even know myself.
All right.
The last one about the baloney. Oh, the biologist
baloney
discovered bacterium that feeds off of caffeine. Of course, that's true. Of course, no, that one's the fake. Come on, where are they going to get the caffeine from? It's ridiculous.
Starbucks.
That's your answer?
Yes, of course it's my answer. I agree with Rebecca.
Okay, Bob.
GWR. I wouldn't recommend it on this one, but...
Well, whatever. It was fun getting there, Rebecca.
Bacteria living on caffeine. Yeah, so what? I mean, that's nothing. Big deal. It could do anything. So I'm totally buying that.
Settle down.
Let's see. Yeah, the second one's interesting. Women finding expressions of happiness less attractive than pride or shame. My take on that is that happiness, a happy smile is such an easy thing for guys to do. It's such an easy kind of reaction, instinctive thing. Even if they're not happy, you know, you just throw out a smile. Big deal. So what? Doesn't really mean anything. But when you express pride or shame, I think it's more likely that you're really experiencing those emotions. As opposed to the happiness. So I think they like that kind of insight into the guy, and they find that more attractive. So that's kind of my take on that. And the electron, the shape of the electron, yeah, I mean, electrons are point particles. I think you were looking for that term, Jay. There is no internal structure, not like a proton, which has got three quarks inside, but yeah, they're point particles. They've got no real internal. They've got no internal structure. But I could kind of see. Yeah, it doesn't make sense that it's egg shaped to me. That to me that seems pretty odd. I would think they would definitely be spherical. An egg shaped electron just doesn't seem right to me. I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Evan.
I'll go in reverse order. The biologists from Dunkin' Donuts discover a bacterium that uses caffeine as its sole food source. I was tempted to go with Rebecca and say that this one is the fiction. But actually, Bob, in his direct and very simplistic sort of approach to it, I think
Bob, he meant bacteria, easy to understand.
Yeah. Is elegant. Really, elegant is the word that we use.
Yeah. Is that what streamlined answer?
Pithy? Okay. Well, whatever you guys want to call
elegant. Elegant's good.
Bob had an influence on me. And like Rebecca, I was thinking that it was that either that or the egg-shaped electron. Now, egg-shaped things in nature, I believe, are rather common. Planets and, you know, things go around other bodies in not perfect circles. You know, they go in ellipses and so forth. So we have lots of examples of these sorts of things happening. But I think Bob's right in that the electron itself doesn't per se have a shape. I think it's kind of undefined. So I don't know how you could say it's distinctly egg-shaped. I just don't see that. I think the word distinctive kind of gives that one away, and I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, so we're evenly split between 1 and 3, which means you all agree on number 2. Researchers find that women find expressions of happiness less attractive than expressions of pride or shame in men. And this one is science.
Of course.
Yes. I'm happy.
Yes.
Oh, wait.
No.
I have
pride. So, yes.
Pride that I got to the answer.
Indeed, women are attracted to the strong, silent, brooding type. Being attracted to expressions of pride makes sense because that's sort of the alpha male, you know, I'm confident, etc. The shame one that seemed counterintuitive to me at first, but they explained that as when you express shame, that means that you respond to social conventions, and it may be a signal that you're trustworthy, because if you lie or do something wrong or bad, you'd be ashamed of what you did.
Yeah, although like being happy is responding to social conditions as well.
Yeah, but you could be a happy psychopath. Shame implies, right, that you're.
Yeah, but psychopaths could fake shame.
They could fake it.
I don't know. I worry that this is a sort of one-off study. Is this like an Evo Psych thing where they're going to present some just-so story to describe why?
Well, they actually mentioned that this is independent of the explanation for it. And there is an evolutionary psychology explanation in that, you know, that these you evolved to respond to certain cues because there's a reproductive advantage there. But you could also interpret it just as learned cultural norms, then, and not really having an evolutionary explanation. But either way, this is how people responded. I agree, though, with you, Rebecca, that this is what they found. Doesn't necessarily mean that this is going to pan out. My question was, you know, they were showing photographs of men and women, you know, with these different emotions. How genuine were the smiles? I mean, were women picking up on the fact that these were photograph smiles and they weren't really genuine?
Yeah, because Richard Wiseman did a study on intuition to determine whether or not people could tell the difference between a real smile and a fake smile. Absolutely. And he found that people were really good at it.
Yeah.
Something 75% of people could tell the difference.
It's hard to fake, too.
As an aside, you use a different part of your brain when you fake smile and real smile.
And your face looks very different because when you fake smile, it's just your mouth. When you real smile, it's your eyes, it's your eyebrows. Like your whole face changes when you smile.
And it's different neural pathways. We actually can do a test if someone has facial weakness due to a stroke, for example, and you tell them to smile and you know only one half of their face curls up. But then if you make them smile by telling them a joke, then they'll smile more symmetrically.
That's interesting.
And this helps us localize where the problem is. Because if the problem's in the cortex, then that demonstration works because when you're real smiling, you're smiling with the deeper, more primitive emotional parts of your brain, and it's bypassing the more voluntary parts of the brain where the stroke might be. But if it's a deeper down pathway, then it doesn't matter. You know, then it'll be the same either way. So that's why we sort of use it as a neurological test. In any case, the other thing about this that they said was that this was just immediate gut reaction, raw sexual attraction. which is not necessarily the same as the kind of person you think would be a good prospect for a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a mate.
Yeah.
This is just, who do you find more attractive quick? You know, and then they, you know, women picked more of the pride and shame over smiling. Men picked more of smiling. So men were attracted to women who were smiling. And men found women more attractive in general than women found men, which is not surprising.
Just in general.
Yeah, it's true. Generally speaking, women are more attractive than men.
I love that so much.
That's true.
That's like saying, that's exactly like saying, you know, men wanted to get laid more than women.
Well, actually, the funny thing is that goes in the face of, well, wait, so... Women, what? Men were more attracted to the women than women were attracted to the men.
Yeah, they ranked the women more attractive than the.
Yeah.
But that could be so artifactual. Wait. I mean, who picked the pictures? You know, was it a bunch of guys? I don't
know. Pre-sex or post-sex?
This is all just looking at photographs.
There's a difference.
Oh boy.
Oh.
Yeah. How many beers are we talking about?
Yeah. And also, like,
exactly.
And also, did they control for whether or not the people were in committed relationships? Things like
all
that,
very good questions. Let's go on to number one.
Moving on.
All questions will be answered at a future time.
New research finds that electrons, rather than being spherical, as previously thought, are distinctly egg-shaped. Bob and Evan think this one is the fiction. Jane and Rebecca think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Oh, oh yeah. God, I'm dying this year.
Don't die.
I told you not to go with me.
So
how the hell do they know those are egg shapes, Steve? Come off it.
It's fiction. They
they're
don't.
Not.
They're not.
That's what I'm saying.
But they did do an experiment published in Nature on May 25th looking at the shape of electrons, and they found that they're just about the most perfectly spherical things we've ever discovered in the universe. In fact, if you blew up an electron to the size of the solar system, it would be a perfect sphere to within a hair's width.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
That's a big electron.
Yeah.
So, Rebecca, we didn't screw up that much. We screwed up enormously this time. Like, it was
the electron, get this. I don't even know if I could pull this off, but the electron differs from being perfectly round by less than 0.000000000000000000000000000000000000000000001 centimeters.
All right, we get it. We really this one.
I might have lost track of the zeros there, but that's
maybe.
You know we're gonna get emails.
Yeah,
Steve was actually off by 2 zeros.
Steve, you forgot 2 zeros there. I love the show. Keep doing a great show.
Ruined my life.
You've wasted my life.
Pretty damn certain.
Steve, how the hell do we know? How can we get to that level of accuracy?
Because they looked at the spinning of the electrons, and if the electrons were if the electrons deviated from a sphere, that would cause them to wobble, and they detected no wobble at all, and that was just the sensitivity of their ability to detect the wobble. So they may even be more perfect than that. We're basically at the limit of our ability.
That's the resolution.
That's the resolution of our ability to look for the wobble. We didn't see any at all.
Wobble this.
So it's like a load of shit to me.
It's at least that close to a sphere. It could be even more.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that cool? So why don't you just punch me and Rebecca right in the face while you're at it?
I'm actually not taking it that hard, so you can just punch Jay.
Okay. All right, Jay, you'll punch. Which means biologists...
Jay, are you feeling shame? Okay.
Yeah, just be ashamed.
Yeah, I am. Rebecca,
very
you find me
you.
Attractive?
You're very attractive to me right now.
Awesome. It worked.
Yeah.
All right, number three, biologist. All right, now I'm distracted. Biologists discover a bacterium that uses caffeine as its sole food source is science, which is cool. And this is kind of a different food source because, you know, you just need to have the pathway of getting the energy-containing molecules off of the caffeine. Caffeine is made of carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, and oxygen, and it contains methyl groups. And these bacteria have enzymes that can strip the methyl groups off of the caffeine and then use them as a food source.
Fred and methyl groups.
Right.
That is really cool.
There are,
so
there are
where does
groups.
The bacteria live, Steve?
Florida.
Let's see.
I just want to know what plant they're eating that has caffeine on
it. It's a type of Pseudomonas. Pseudomonas putida.
Oh, that explains everything.
Get that, Jay.
Don't know where they isolated it from. So good work, Bob and Evan.
Good job, guys.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Those are high five. Those are fun news items.
Yeah.
Rebecca, we screwed up so bad. Let's do a low five this week. Ready?
All right.
Hey, that was pretty low.
Yeah, well, low five. That's how we're feeling.
Down low.
Steve, I have a provocative quote by a man named Lewis Thomas.
Go for it, Jay.
Does anybody know who Lewis Thomas was first?
Yeah, he was a physician, a poet, and an etymologist.
There you go.
Steve, you're so smart.
Yeah. Good job, Steve. Wow. This quote happened to be sent in by a man named Alex Selvianova.
Does anybody know who Alex Selvianova is?
Selvianova.
This is a quote sent in by Alex Selvianova.
Selvianova.
Okay, I'm sorry, Alex.
Smith. Gotcha.
The capacity to blunder slightly is the real marvel of DNA. Without this special attribute, we would still be anaerobic bacteria and there would be no music. Lewis Thomas!
Cool.
Is that maybe bacteria music?
Well, only if there's caffeine involved.
Steve, I want to thank you ahead of time for this week.
Okay, Jay.
Because we have no announcement.
Then you have to go back
in
time.
We do have an announcement. We do have an announcement, actually. The announcement is the SGU dinner at TAM 9.
Ooh, tell me about that.
Which is going to be Saturday night of TAM. And I'm bringing this up because for two reasons. One is it's selling out very quickly. We're getting close already. In fact, we already passed our number for last year, but we're hoping to get a bigger venue. But even still, if you want to get tickets, we probably are going to sell out. So hurry up. And someone asked if they got the all pass, I guess the TAM all pass, and they wanted to know if that included the SGU dinner. And the answer is no. The SGU dinner is a completely separate event you have to register for separately, even if you have the all pass. It's going to be a fun time. We've expanded it to 3 hours, too, because we didn't have enough. 2 hours is not enough time for us to spend with our listeners last year.
Yeah, they were gonna, shutting the lights off on us and clearing the tables.
We are going to do an auction again, and Richard Saunders has agreed to do to be the auctioneer. He did just a wonderful job last year. And we're also going to have some kind of a special show just for the people who come to the dinner.
What do you mean?
Dog and pony.
Yeah, some kind of dog and pony show. A poll will be involved.
For those of us friending us on Facebook, thank you very much. We appreciate it. However, please make sure that you go to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe fan page and like that page, please. Not us individually, but it's the SGU page.
I can't add any more friends.
Yeah, that's why we have the SGU page. We wanted it's a fan page that can have an unlimited number of people. And follow us on Twitter and read our blogs because we write them.
We do write them.
We do.
Sometimes. Sometimes I pay orphans to write them for me.
I have a ghostwriter sometimes.
So thank you for joining me again this week, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good show.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune or your portal of choice. We'll be right back.